most manipulative smile of her life, adding, "I'm only asking because I trust your opinion above everyone else's." Jack seemed to enjoy this.
"All right. Suppose we'd best start with Mr. Carter," Jack said finally.
"Yes," Etta thought. "Let's."
"He's a right fine seaman, and I like him fine. Kind. Teaches me letters when he isn't barking at the other men, which he don't have to do, understand? Reads to me sometimes when I brings him his breakfast. Reads so much, I don't see how he don't get bored with all them words."
Jack made a face.
"He's the prize master. He'll bring the ship into the prize courts and get our earnings. I know he don't like turtle soup much. Always makes a face when I serve it to him. He's from... well, I don't rightly know. Captain Orr raised him, though. Is that what you meant, miss?"
Etta nodded. "Exactly what I meant." Jack went through the roster of the prize crew, noting how much he liked each man, which ones burped most often after he served them, which ones snored, the ones who had perished in horrifically brutal ways during the boarding. It shifted naturally into chatting about the work above, his excitement during the boarding, how some of the boys from this ship, the Ardent, had agreed to work for Mr. Carter, but they didn't much like Jack yet. She was so distracted by his torrent of words, she missed the fact that he was guiding the brush through her hair easily now, top to bottom, top to bottom, until it felt silky and only a bit damp to the touch.
"How'd you like it fashioned?"
he asked her, gesturing to her hair.
"I'll just braid it," Etta began. "Thank you for your help." "I can do that, miss," Jack said.
"You can?"
"A sailor who can't braid's no sailor at all," he proclaimed. "Learned to marry and braid the lines and ropes first thing."
"Marry them?" Etta asked, glancing up at him under a curtain of her hair. He'd been appalled by her sitting on the floor, but it was the only way for him to stand over her to do his work.
"Aye, splice and bind the ends of two ropes together, so that they're one. Join them together, like."
She wondered if that's where the word had come from. Why you married someone when you joined your life to theirs. How strange, casting something she thought she knew in a different light, tracing its unexpected origins back. Here was one small, unexpected benefit to time travel. At least she was learning something. Something she would only be able to use in trivia games, but still.
"The devil are you, Jack Winstead?" a voice called.
Jack shot over to the door and pulled it open.
"Christ, lad, were you hiding in there? The new cook's a beast, but he won't eat you."
Etta pushed herself to her feet. The man at the door was younger than she'd expected, given the deep baritone of his voice. She recognized it, though, as the one that had been booming out over the others, issuing commands, even singing. His dirty blonde hair was tied back at the nape of his neck, giving her a nice view of his round, open face and a stitched-up cut running along one cheek. He had the wide shoulders and rounded chest of a pigeon, but moved to snatch Jack's collar like a hawk.
"I'm so sorry. It's my fault for keeping him," Etta said, feeling almost frantic.
He wouldn't hurt the boy, would he? The other man looked up, releasing Jack.
"Oh, beg your pardon, Miss Spencer. If he was assisting you, it's all right."
Jack turned back to her, eyes wide.
"He was," Etta confirmed.
The man looked down at him.
"Cook's been calling your name for the past quarter hour. Go on, look lively, lad."
He tore out of the room, only to have the man catch him by the collar and drag him back. Jack did his quick version of a bow.
"Pleasant evening to you, miss."
"We'll teach that one manners yet,"
the man said with a faint trace of exasperation.
"Though I seem to be lacking them myself. I'm Davy Chase, first mate of the prize crew."
Etta wasn't sure what to do with herself as he drew his heels together and gave her yet another bow. Curtsy? Nod? She ran through what Jack had given her about him. Likes. Music, ale, dock wenches. Dislikes. Cabin boys who don't follow orders. Winters in New England. Tea. Most interesting, however, was the fact that he'd been raised, fostered, really, by Captain Hall and his late wife, alongside Nicholas.
"Are you well? You gave us quite the fright," he continued.
"Better now, thank you," she said carefully, pleased she had managed to sound calm and collected. Maybe this would get easier, or at least more comfortable, with practice.
I see your sister is still poorly. Rather, I smelt as much as I passed her cabin. That's a poor stomach for you.
He looked like he was fighting a small smile, and in that moment, Etta decided she liked him.
I've had the cook make a broth that should help settle her some. We'll get her in shape to sail again soon.
The sooner Sophia recovered, the sooner Etta would be back under the girl's watchful eye. Etta needed all the time she could to win the crew over, to turn the ship around, back to whatever port it had sailed from. Back, hopefully, to the passage leading to New York in her time.
And you? Will you be joining us for dinner this evening?
Etta opened her mouth to decline. Exhaustion had made even her bones feel heavy, and she needed to practice speaking in their formal way before she trusted herself to hold a full conversation. But her stomach answered for her with a loud, rumbling groan. Etta's face flamed as she fumbled for an apology, but his warm brown eyes only lit up in delight.
"I believe I have my answer," he said, and held out his arm.
5. Mr. Edward Wren had clearly never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. Nicholas sat back against his chair, fighting the urge to knock a fist against the table and move the conversation, by force if necessary, past Wren's staggering tale of past valor. As far as Nicholas was concerned, half-truths only added up to a whole lie. Glancing around the table, he gauged each diner's reaction. From his prize crew, the men who had boarded the Ardent with him and assumed control of it, was Trevors, the bosun, deep into his cups, his teeth stained with port. The man had actually nodded off, clutching a stomach distended from eating his own weight in lobscouse and buttered parsnips. To his right was another surviving officer of the Ardent's crew, Heath, the sailing master. The older gentleman's right ear was bandaged beneath a flop of a wig, and he spent the entirety of the dinner turning in his chair to try to hear what was being said by Miss Henrietta Spencer, who inhaled her meal with a wolfish enthusiasm that Nicholas found himself appreciating. Henrietta Ironwood? He wondered. The old man's letter had been vague. There hadn't been an indication either way. But she seemed to lack the venom that pumped through the family's heart. It was entirely possible, however, that she was the kind to nestle close before sinking her fangs in for the kill. His eyes shifted to her right, where the newly appointed surgeon and all-around milksop, Goody, was focused on cutting his food into bites small enough for a chick.
"Miss Spencer, we haven't touched a bite of the lobscouse. I can't recommend it enough," Heath blurted out, nearly shouting over Wren's quieter tones.
Nicholas had been in his position before, the agonizing ringing and temporary deafness of coming too close to cannon fire, and couldn't fault the older man for his booming voice.
"It's cook's specialty."
Knowing that they'd be eating hard biscuits and turtle soup every night if he let one of the prize crew take control of the galley, Nicholas had reluctantly agreed to let the Ardent's cook stay in his position after meeting him. The man had all but shackled himself to the stove, stoic and grim, as he offered up a pastry as proof of his skill. He kept his appearance well enough, with a trim dark beard and hair cued neatly. More importantly, Cook had tolerated his presence on the ship, having clearly lived through any number of boardings in his time.
"It's made from salted beef that Cook hangs over the side of the ship until it freshens," Goody explained. "The stew is merely beef, potatoes, onions, and a little pepper if he has it."
Henrietta, no, Etta, no, Miss Spencer, favored Jack, one of the cabin boys, with a small smile as he sprang forward to spoon the stew into her bowl. They watched as she took a careful bite, compressing her lips at the taste, swallowing hard. She managed to choke out a single word.
"Delicious!"
"There's a good girl," Chase said with a chuckle.
As fair-haired as an angel and as big as a bear, his friend, the first mate for the remainder of their journey, was a study in contradictions. An open, round face, perpetually tinged with pink, displayed his irrepressible good nature. He had been one of the few to sneakily thumb away his tears of relief when Miss Spencer had awoken. Moments later, he'd been back at work, assisting the others in patching the hull and singing bawdy songs in the highest register he could manage. And tonight, following the dinner's conclusion and the final watch, he'd be in his hammock, darning his and the crew's stockings with exquisite care. On the deck, however, Chase was as formidable as a mountain.
There was no quarter for shirking duties or disrespect, not without fear of the cat-o'-nine-tails or a fist sailing towards your soft parts. Usually a good pint or glass of wine was enough to put Chase in high spirits, but Nicholas was almost relieved that the other man looked as surly as he himself felt. Maybe he wasn't the only one exhausted by this whole ordeal. Wren smiled fondly at Etta, Miss Spencer, and gestured to his bowl, still full from the first serving.
I don't like it much myself. The curse of having a refined palate, I suppose. But I swear to you, I would have eaten this every day rather than starve on the island with the others.
Bloody hell, would there be no mercy from this? By some unfortunate act of God, Wren was another surviving officer of the Ardent, which unfortunately granted him the privilege of attending meals in the captain's cabin, outside of where he and the other men were being kept in the hold. Nicholas took a steadying breath of the savory, salty smell of the lobscouse, and allowed Jack to refill his bowl when he emptied it. The boy's hands shook slightly from nerves. This was his first voyage, and Nicholas remembered the feeling well.
"You're doing a fine job," he muttered to the boy. "Well done."
Jack straightened up, setting his shoulders back. He struggled to keep the smile off his face as he moved to serve Chase. When he arrived at Wren's side, the man broke off his story only long enough to give the boy the full brunt of his condescension.
"Have you gone deaf as well? I said I wasn't fond of it."
Wren glanced at Nicholas.
"Your charity shows no limit, employing half-wits and simpletons."
A growl curled in Chase's throat at the same time as the spoon in Jack's hand slipped from his fingers and landed with a wet thump in Wren's lap.
"You damned—"
Nicholas's body tensed as the other man raised his hand. The impertinence could be dealt with, but not like this. For whatever weakness other men might accuse him of, Nicholas would never condone striking a child, even to discipline him.
"Mr. Wren!"
He wasn't quite sure how she moved as quickly as she did in those heavy skirts, but Etta was suddenly standing over Wren, settling a hand on his shoulder.
"Oh, no,"
Etta said loudly.
"How clumsy, Jack. You'd better apologize."
Chase yanked Jack out of Wren's reach as the man glanced at Etta, distracted for a moment from his anger.
"Sorry," Jack mumbled.
Chase gave him a little shake, and the boy added,
"Sir."
"It's all right, isn't it? Accidents happen," Etta continued soothingly, picking up Wren's displaced napkin.
"There you go."
She turned slightly as she reclaimed her seat, meeting Nicholas's gaze evenly. Well, that was a masterful manipulation of the moment. He tilted his head in acknowledgement. "Well played." Etta tilted hers right back, cocking an eyebrow as if to ask, "And where were you?" He bit back an unwelcome grin at the challenge.
"The bugger did it on purpose," Wren insisted.
Etta continued, "Now what were you saying about the island and food?" As Wren was, mystifyingly, an officer, he was granted a measure of respect by the able-bodied seamen of both crews, including the ship's boys. There were standards of how a captured crew was to be treated, and the truth was Jack would need to be disciplined for his actions. There was no way to avoid it without stepping on the exasperating decorum of it all. But Miss Spencer... He turned to find Chase watching her with brows raised. She'd blown out the flame before the fire could catch. Now, however, Miss Spencer seemed to devour each of Wren's words like bites of a second supper. Ironwood had trained her well. Nicholas would need to watch her to ensure that he himself wasn't being played. Or perhaps the better strategy was to stop watching her altogether. The candlelight was doing fascinating things to both the silk of her gown and the color in her cheeks. She struggled to lift her fork to her mouth, clearly in discomfort from the fit of her gown. Perhaps that, too, explained the breathy way she laughed and laughed at Wren's inane jokes. Where was the little lioness, he wondered, roaming the decks with her hair down and floating like a cloud around her? The one who'd looked ready and willing to do violence to two men twice her size, with a grappling hook nonetheless. She'd gone into the cabin wild, burning, and come out as cool and pale as a pearl. If she'd coiffed her hair and powdered it, he might have been convinced he was watching someone from his own century. Beside her, Edward Wren was the pride of bloody England with his beautiful manners and charm. Nicholas had made a dispassionate assessment of him when the Ardent's first mate was brought up from the hold, and had found him lacking in everything but pretty manners. The look on his face when Hall had introduced Nicholas as the master of the ship. His fingers closed around the silver knife, gripping it until his breath was steady. Disbelief. Disgust. Worse even than Sophia's open malice. They'd made their introductions just as Captain Hall and the Challenger were readying to sail. Not a single word had passed between them after the captain left. They'd merely studied one another, Wren taking stock of him the way he would a horse he was considering purchasing. Nicholas returned the favor now. Dark hair, dark eyes, heroically bruised and bloodied naturally. Wren was a great deal shorter than Nicholas, but walked with his chest puffed out and his chin raised, as if he was always on his way to meet the king.
"Watch that one," Hall had muttered as he returned to the Challenger to continue their hunt. "Both eyes open, Nick. He'll make as if to cut your throat from the front as another knife slices clean through your back. He won't see his hands move." "A charming image."
Nicholas laughed, but the older man was grave.
"I know his type. More wind than a tempest and more pride than Lucifer himself."
Nicholas wished he could have convinced the captain to stay, but Hall, floating on the wave of victory, was already eager for another prize, and no doubt to have Nicholas make a quick journey of it back to New London. Captain Hall had clasped his shoulder and pounded his back, light eyes sparkling as the sunset turned the sky a warm rose.
"I know you're ready for this and more. Finish your business with the family and meet us back in port."
A pure thrill moved from his scalp down his spine, warming him to the core. "I am ready." He wanted his own command the way the dying wanted their next breath. It was just a matter, as always, of money, of outrunning the ghost in his past that seemed to haunt him at every turn. "Nick, help me. Help me." He breathed in deeply through his nose, his fingers twisting in the tablecloth as if caught in a memory of their own. The past was past. Now he needed to see the young ladies safely delivered into the hands of Cyrus Ironwood, and escape whole and preferably unscathed. By the time he was finished with that task, finished with that family for once and all, Chase and the others would already have the Ardent in the hands of the Lowe's agent, who'd then bring her and her cargo to the prize courts for a ruling. A crucial part of that process was the testimony of the ranking officer of the captured vessel. He couldn't stab his fork into Wren's eye. Well, he supposed he could. The man only needed his mouth to serve as witness to the courts that the vessel had been fairly won. Did every nicety need to be observed? His stomach soured again as Miss Spencer gave a pretty little gasp of dismay. Wren, brave Mr. Wren, consoled her by saying,
"Do not fret, my dear. I have stitched up more than one wound myself. This was, however, the first time I had ever seen my own entrails."
Nicholas scoffed. If a man could see his own entrails, he could also see the hand of God swooping down to take him to his eternal reward. There was no living with a wound like that. He had seen enough proof to drive that fact home, even if his guest had not. Guest. A dark, humorless laugh welled up inside him. Hostage, really, but why use the true term when you could be polite? If there was one thing Nicholas loathed more than almost anything else, it was this. Behaving, even to an enemy, with hollow civility and false flatteries. He preferred to be direct in his dislike, and if that did not make him a gentleman from society's mold, well, then so be it.
"The ship was tossed onto the reef by the swells. There was simply nothing we could do other than hold on to her as she was wrecked. Those of us that survived, who made it to the sandbank, crawled ashore. We lived as savages for a week, foraging for food, hunting wild boar, creating shelters from palm leaves and whatever dry wood we could find, searching day and night for water. There was only a single knife between us, a blessing, I think, for we were so out of our minds we might have killed each other in a murderous rage had there been more." "A cry and pity that would have been," Chase grumbled, jabbing his spoon into the stew.
Nicholas cleared his throat. Chase's green eye slid over to meet his, and he raised his glass. The prize crew was, by Hall's design, filled with sailors who had known Nicholas for years. Davy Chase had known him the longest.
He and Chase had been brought aboard Captain Hall's old ship, the Lady Anne, to serve as cabin boys, just weeks before the Lady Anne was torn apart at the seams by a squall. Both they and the captain had been pressed into temporary service in His Majesty's Navy by the very same ship that rescued them from the waves. Wren told his story in hushed tones, his voice rising and falling with each imagined danger. Having survived his own ordeal at age 11, living through 2 days and nights of starvation, thirst, and fear of death from exposure in the rough winter waters, Nicholas found himself growing steadily more impatient. Hall had kept him and Chase alert and distracted by relating stories about his travels as a young man in the West Indies, his favorite dock doxies, a past storm when the water, the masts, the deck had been lit by strange blue flame, the small hoard of old Spanish bullion he'd all but tripped over, running from the British regulars through Tortola. The experience wasn't something Nicholas spoke of now. It wasn't something he enjoyed thinking about. His lips had cracked and bled, burning at all hours from the salt water, and there were times even now when he imagined he could still feel the splinters beneath his nails from the section of the bulwark he had clung to. His vision had gone dark at the start of the third day, and panic had choked him, until Captain Hall had swum to his side and held him afloat by force. The rescue had only been the beginning of another nightmare. Something ugly in Nicholas stirred when the first mate put an all-too-forward hand on Etta's bare wrist. Something made him want to promptly remove the whole arm from the man's body. She is a job. She is a means to an end. But she was also not Wren's.
"Mr. Wren," he interrupted.
The resulting silence cracked over the cabin like a whip.
"Perhaps you'd be so good as to clarify one point in your story."
The other man's face twisted into a smirk.
"Of course. What troubles you?"
Wren's first mistake had been to assume that those around him had never sailed through the Virgin Islands.
"You mentioned that the island where you ran aground was about 2 leagues from Tortola, did you not? Just northeast of Peter Island."
Chase's chair creaked as he shifted his weight. Wren's own smile slipped for a moment, but he said,
"Yes, I believe I did. I thought, surely, that you must be referring to Dead Chest Island,"
Nicholas began, wondering if he looked half as diabolical as he felt.
"I am,"
Wren said, a slight flush creeping over his face.
"I wasn't aware you were familiar with it."
That much was obvious.
"I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a sailor who hasn't heard of it, sir,"
Nicholas said.
"That is the island where Blackbeard set his 15 sailors ashore with only cutlasses and a bottle of rum between them, in retaliation for their mutiny. Correct?"
"That is correct,"
Chase confirmed happily.
"They tried swimming to Peter Island, but drowned. That's why they call that stretch of sand Dead Man's Beach, of course, owing to the bodies that washed ashore."
Etta leaned forward, unexpected interest sparking in her eyes at this delightfully gruesome detail.
"Really?" "Truly. But that's the trouble, you see," Nicholas said,
turning back to Wren, whose smile seemed frozen.
"Having seen Dead Chest myself, I'm afraid it doesn't match your description. It's an outcropping of rocks, with no fresh water, no vegetation, and certainly no wild boar for you to hunt."
His spoon scraped against the bottom of his bowl. When he dared look up again, Etta was watching him, biting her bottom lip. Her eyes sparkled with laughter, and he felt a small bundle of warmth tuck away inside of his chest in response. Wren busied himself with the task of refilling both his and Etta's glasses with claret. Perhaps it was the awkwardness, or the fact that Wren seemed to be steaming enough to curl a wig, but Etta drank the dark wine in a single gulp, and sang, in a charmingly tipsy way, 15 men on the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum!" Nicholas blinked. Silverware clinked as it was set down on plates. Chairs creaked as the men around her shifted, turning toward her. Etta blanched, looking down at her lap, as if her skirt would offer up some kind of excuse.
"Where did you hear such an extraordinary song?" Wren asked.
The question instantly sobered her, dousing the flush of laughter from her cheeks. She sat up as straight as a mainmast in her seat, pushing her wineglass away, and steeled her expression to try to hide the flash of regret and panic he saw in her eyes.
Nicholas wished she would look up, to see how easily mended this was. If Sophia was not here to mop up her spills, he would gladly take on the challenge.
"Perhaps from Captain Hall. He has a charming repertoire of songs," he suggested.
Chase gave him a narrow look.
"That's not one I've heard before. Is there more to it?"
"It was in a book I read with my mother," she said vaguely. "We used to read adventure stories before bed. I don't remember the rest. Excuse me for being, so rude."
"Rude? Nonsense. What a delightful voice you have,"
Wren said.
"Do you have any other musical ability, Miss Spencer? Perhaps you'll treat us to a song later on."
"Grateful for that shift in subject, aren't you, Weasel?" Nicholas thought. No, well..." She looked at the ceiling for rescue, more panicked than before. "I play the violin."
"The violin? That's most irregular," Wren said. "I suppose I'm out of touch with the training you ladies receive. Are there many instruments of quality in the West Indies?"
Etta straightened and repeated, "The West Indies?" A horrible suspicion snaked through Nicholas's mind. Was there a possibility that she didn't know the location of whatever passage she had come through? But then, wouldn't that mean... She's not here of her own free will. Anger flashed through him at the thought, and he brought his boot down against the rug, as if to stomp it out. "It does not matter. Your concern is bringing her to the old man." But he knew the feeling of being caught in the Ironwood's net. He knew it very well indeed.
"Ah, if I remember correctly, there's a violin somewhere around here,"
Goody said, glancing around the cabin. Aside from the shelves of warped book spines, a sturdy desk, and the berth for sleeping, there wasn't all that much to observe.
"Perhaps Nicholas will be so good as to search for it, so that we might hear you play tomorrow," Wren said. "Mr. Carter," Chase bit out. "Curse my clumsy tongue," Wren said, raising a glass in a mocking salute.
Nicholas raised his own.
"Thankfully you have a sparkling imagination to make up for it."
His lips tight, Wren turned his attention to Etta, who was toying with a spoon.
"I must say, I'm highly affronted that the captain kept such lovely young ladies from us, though I suppose I can see why he would want to shield the crew from such radiant beauty."
Nicholas choked on his next sip of claret. Etta flushed from her cheeks down to the slope of... He returned his eyes back to his plate, gripping his knees beneath the table.
"I meant to ask about that very thing," Chase said to her. "The others only knew there were passengers because these two gentlemen were moved to the bosun's and carpenter's cabins in the bow. They were as startled as the Challenger's crew to see you."
"My sister, as you know," Etta said carefully, "is not well. We were confined to the cabin because of that."
"Why did you not ask for the surgeon? Both Mr. Farthing and I would have been glad to have been of assistance," Goody said.
Nicholas registered the girl's expression. Her silence was telling.
"Likely because a surgeon would try to fix with a saw what water and broth could easily soothe," he said. "I resent that implication, sir. There have been advances in medicine, and having studied..." "I can hardly credit the two of you as sisters," Chase said,
pushing the hair off his forehead.
"You're so markedly different in appearance and accent."
Nicholas kicked his foot beneath the table. A drunken Chase was a blunt Chase.
"That observation is hardly polite," Wren said coolly. "I only meant to ask if they've different mothers is all," Chase groused. "My apologies, Miss Spencer, if offense was taken."
"That's all right," Etta said weakly.
"And the late captain was your uncle?"
Where the devil are you going with this? Nicholas thought, studying his old friend.
"It was indeed Mr. Chase,"
Mr. Goody said, venturing into the conversation again with a disapproving look.
"Related to Miss Sophia's mother, their father's first wife. Correct me if I misunderstood his story, Miss Spencer, but I take it to understand your father and his second wife, your mother, had a fine plantation on Nassau before they lately passed away. Miss Sophia was bringing her sister back with her to England."
"Yes," Etta said quickly. "That's exactly right." This was beyond belief. Ironwood had actually seen to it that an elaborate history was created to explain the differences between the girls. If he had to guess, the old man had bribed the captain to pose as their uncle, so they would have an escort and protection on this journey, as the rules of the era dictated.
"It's regrettable," Wren interrupted to regain Etta's attention, "that your voyage was so rudely interrupted. Will you be able to get word to the family waiting for you in England that you were forced to alter your destination? My God, what if they think you've been lost at sea? Imagine their devastation."
He was looking at Etta, but clearly speaking to Nicholas.
"Rest assured, sir,"
Nicholas said with a patience he did not know he possessed.
"They will be able to write to their family once we are in port. They will be well cared for until we can find them safe passage home. There's bound to be a Royal Navy ship or a British Army encampment near enough to Connecticut willing to assist them." "Ah, yes. I long to hear how this little skirmish is shaping up. How long before Washington surrenders? Let's place our bets, gentlemen."
Wren's fingers drummed against the table.
"Perhaps another month. I've heard Howe has his eyes set on New York. That would be a terrible blow to your army's efforts, would it not? The loss of such a vital port and city."
"They certainly aren't my efforts," Nicholas said,
an uneasiness creeping up upon him.
"I have no investment in this war beyond what ships it brings to the water that we can capture."
"Really?" Etta asked. "But I thought this crew was American."
"Well, Americans were Englishmen until a few months ago," Chase said. "Some on our crew still consider themselves to be. But the Challenger sails under a letter of marque from the Continental Congress, and we're authorized to prey only on British ships. So I suppose that seals our allegiance." "A lot of good those papers will do for you if you come across the Royal Navy," Wren said. "Traitors are worse than murderers in the eyes of the King. A length of rope will be your reward."
"Please, sir," Chase begged, holding up a hand.
"I've enough of a headache without a bloody recitation of Rule Britannia."
Wren's look was withering.
"I only meant, Mr. Carter, it strikes me as odd you wouldn't want to join your Congress's fledgling navy. Surely there's some fortune to be found in legitimacy over piracy. Perhaps some honor?"
Chase snorted.
"A fraction of what we'll take on board a privateer. Rest assured, this is a legal endeavor, much to your own misfortune."
Nicholas raised his own glass, but recognized the glint in Wren's eyes. The name belied its true nature. This was an Osprey across from him, one that was wheeling in circles, waiting to dive.
"I don't understand," Etta said, looking uneasily around the table.
"Why is it odd? It's his choice to stay out of the American Navy, isn't it?" It was the opening the other man had been hoping for.
"Why, on his brethren's behalf," Wren said, his smile all teeth. "Surely all this commotion about freedom and liberty has stirred some memories of the chains of his past. Though I've also heard that, unlike the British, there have been no offers of freedom in exchange for military service for the slaves of the colonies."
Hall had told him once that if Nicholas allowed his dislike of every man who insulted him to sharpen into hatred, he'd only end up cutting himself. But truly, did Wren think pointing out the obvious would somehow discredit Nicholas in the eyes of the others, that it would undermine his authority? "You may have this," Wren was saying, "this moment, this ship, but you'll never be anything other than what men like me decide you are." Never. Never again would he allow any other man to define him, set his course. Chase shot to his feet so fast that his chair toppled backwards. His blood rushed the other way, straight to his face.
"Sir, I'd call you out if—"
Nicholas put a hand on his friend's shoulder, stood to retrieve his chair, and promptly guided him back into it.
"Remember that there's a lady present, my friend."
The very same one who looked perfectly horrified. What a wonderful meal this was turning out to be. And to think there'd likely be about 10 other variations of it as they sailed north toward New York. Nicholas refilled his friend's glass with more claret, hoping it would settle his temper instead of stoking it.
"Are you speaking of Dunmore's proclamation in Virginia last year?"
he said, ignoring Wren's smug expression.
in which slaves of rebels would earn their freedom by escaping and fighting for the British Army. The Continental Congress has, in fact, encouraged the Virginians to dispute the ruling, and they have since driven the governor out. I can't credit your implication that all slaves will be free at the end of this exercise either. The king is well aware of how much the colonies rely on enslaved labor to produce the goods he enjoys. He means only to punish his wayward children by taking away their tools, empty their pockets for a time. Nothing is likely to change.
Wren turned his glass on the table. Nicholas met the man's eyes, trying to keep the loathing from his own.
In truth, Nicholas said, I simply cannot abide the hypocrisy of fighting for a man who supposedly embodies the ideals of freedom, while at home dozens of slaves work his land.
Not to mention any number of military expeditions that this man had fumbled in his youth, and how he had never been deemed worthy of a commission in the British Army. He admired the man's tenacity, but the moment he'd learned the colonies would actually win the war, he could have been knocked over by a feather.
"Do you mean Washington?" Etta asked, startled.
Nicholas nodded.
"You should also know, Mr. Wren, that I am a free man, and that will never change."
"How diverting!"
Heath offered loudly, only to deflate when he saw the faces around him. Nicholas watched as a cabin boy brought in some sort of pudding for dessert.
"Perhaps it will change," Wren said as his pudding was placed in front of him. "Should the colonies break away and the landowners in the South seize control of the new government, they will be in the position to create their own Eden. Isn't it fair to say that slavery has been a boon to Africans? At the very least, it breaks them of their laziness and their barbaric violence, brings them into God's flock. The work they do is fit for their capacities."
Ah, yes, here it was, 100 years' worth of justifications for the wrongful enslavement of human beings, gathered into a tidy single breath of hot air. These sweeping lies about the minds of Africans, the denial of every opportunity to advance themselves by reading and writing and thinking, kept them not only in physical chains, but insidious, invisible ones as well. It didn't matter that none of it was true, that Nicholas himself stood as evidence of it. What mattered was that these beliefs had swept through the souls of everyone else like a plague. He couldn't see the end of it. Even 100 years in the future, he knew, the roots still had not been fully pulled up from society. Wherever, whenever he went, the color of his skin set the boundaries of what he could achieve, and there was very little, if any, recourse for finding a way around it. Etta's palms were pressed flat against the table, and she was breathing hard in an obvious attempt to master her. Anger? Was she angry? On his behalf? If Wren had spared her a glance, he might have thought twice before adding,
"I suppose you owe your faculties to your father, perhaps. Forgive me if I've made incorrect assumptions about your parentage."
"You have not, Mr. Wren," Nicholas said, wondering why he had ever resisted the urge to lodge the fork in the man's eye. "To your point, though, I suppose we are all born with deficits. In your case, in manners."
He understood this now for what it really was, punishment for having made the other man feel like a fool, first with the seizure of the Ardent, and tonight revealing his lies. His knowledge in itself was enough to settle him somewhat. The pettiness of it stripped some of the pain as these old wounds were sliced open. Wren swayed in his seat, the full effect of the claret seeming to strike him all at once. His words became slippery at the edges, slurred slightly, as his eyes gleamed, giving his anger a darker edge.
"What was it that Voltaire supposedly said? Your race is a species of men, as different from ours as a breed of bulldogs is to terriers."
"Mr. Wren,"
Etta began, scarlet in the face.
"Having actually read the Voltaire in question, I can confirm the quote is, as different from ours as the breed of spaniels is from that of greyhounds,"
Nicholas said coldly.
"Interesting, though, that in the end we're all just dogs."
"Perhaps,"
Wren said, leaning forward in his seat.
"But not all of us are mutts without pedigree."
Etta stood at the same moment as Chase, only she was the one close enough to land a slap on the officer's face.
The crack of flesh on flesh stunned Nicholas, who'd leapt up to restrain his friend from lunging across the table.
"And these are the actions of a lady,"
Wren sputtered.
"Aye," Chase said approvingly. "And a damn fine one at that."
"Can you actually hear the words coming out of your mouth?" she demanded, pieces of her hair falling out of its braid as she threw an arm out toward the door. "You need to leave the table. Right now." Wren's eyes narrowed at her tone. Nicholas didn't like the way the man was looking her over, as if preparing to strike. Strike her. Nicholas's fingers pressed against the knife he'd set on his plate.
"I beg your pardon, madam," Wren said, "if I've caused you any offense."
"You know I'm not the one you offended," she said, trembling with anger. "I think it's time for you to leave." Wren folded his hands together and rested them on his chest.
"I haven't eaten my pudding yet."
"Oh, my God, you are despicable," Etta snarled.
"Careful, madam. Blasphemy is still a sin."
Even if Nicholas had been the gambling sort, he would never have wagered a single coin on her next words being,
"Then I guess I'll see you in hell."
The look of outrage on her face would have sent even Nicholas flying to the other end of the ship. He wondered, not for the first time, when she was from. What era had produced such a fearsome, magnificent temper? But Wren stayed precisely where he was, the smug arse. And it was Etta who left the room in a whirl of skirts. Chase craned his neck around.
"That one I like."
Nicholas waited, but didn't hear the telltale slam of a second door, meaning she hadn't gone back into her cabin.
"That one is up on the deck, alone."
He implicitly trusted his crew, but no lady of this era was allowed to wander in these circumstances unescorted. And there were plenty of ways for her to be injured, never mind tossed overboard in a swell. Moreover, he was a little frightened that she had set out to find another grappling hook. He stood, turning back to his friend.
"See to it that Mr. Wren is returned to the hold. And, sir," he said, returning his gaze to the weasel, who was contentedly eating beside a shocked Goody, "you will not be dining with us for the duration of our journey. Call my character into question as you like. But if it reaches my ears that you've attempted to besmirch Miss Spencer and her reputation, you will find yourself without a tongue to enjoy your future meals."
It was a relief to be free from the warm, muggy air inside the cabin. What with the wine and the upset in his stomach, he'd felt like he was being slowly drawn into an unwilling sleep. The dark autumn air brushed his skin sweetly, a balm to the heat trapped beneath it. She'd walked only a short distance along the starboard side on the quarter-deck, and was standing at the rail. The wind pressed back against her gown, molding it further to her shape. The full moon cast her in ivory light, stretching its hand out over the water in a trail leading to the horizon. If not for her pose, the arms crossed over her chest as she surveyed the dark sea churning around her, she might have been one of the great master's statues brought to life. And in a thousand different ways, she was just as entirely out of his reach. 6.
Damn, damn, damn.
Etta scrubbed the cold, salty water from her eyes and cheeks with one hand, and clawed at the front of the dress with the other. She couldn't dislodge the ball of panic that had settled just under her ribs. The stays were squeezing so tightly that her spine ached each time she took a shallow breath. Worse, though, was the throbbing sting in the palm of her right hand, an unwelcome reminder of how badly she'd blown dinner. If, when, word got back to Sophia that, one, she'd gone to dinner, and, two, had made a mess of it, Etta would be lucky if the girl let her go to the head unsupervised to relieve herself. Wandering the ship and winning over the crew? Out of the question entirely. Everything had been fine, or mostly fine, through the first hour. Mr. Wren, no, just Wren, he didn't deserve any better, had droned on until his dinner grew cold in front of him, sucking up what energy she had left. Despite the worldly airs he put on, Etta didn't think Wren, or Edward, whatever name he'd tried to whisper in her ear, was all that older than herself, or even Nicholas. She pressed a hand to her mouth. Nicholas. Every ounce of Etta beat back against the thought, but there was no way around the truth. Sophia had been right. Etta really had no idea what it was like to live during a time where you had no legal or societal protections in place. All she'd learned from that dinner was how very helpless you were to other people's perceptions. Nicholas didn't need her to fight his battles for him. He'd been doing a masterful job of handling Ren, turning each remark back on the other man, proving, without directly stating so, what an absolute idiot he was. He never gave in to the anger that the other man was obviously trying to stir up. Etta hated the tired resignation she'd seen in his face as Ren had exposed his own ignorance and hatred, the obvious expectation of it. And then Ren had the nerve to look around the table, like he was waiting for the rest of them to agree. The anger that had flooded her veins was so pure, she thought it must have turned her blood to acid. She could read 100 books about the attitudes and beliefs of the past, but the impact of witnessing this casual, ignorant cruelty firsthand was like having a bucket of ice upended over your head. It forced Etta to see that the centuries padding this time and hers, along with simple privilege, had protected her from the true ugliness of it. People believed this trash, and they were spreading it around like it was nothing, like they weren't even talking about humans. Etta braced her arms against the rail, looking out over the dark water. The peak of each ruffling wave caught the moonlight, turning them a sparkling silver. A symphony of sounds moved around her. The slap of the water against the ship's curved sides, the fluttering of the huge sails overhead, the thump of something deep below, a rudder, maybe. She'd found the creaking wood unnerving at first, wondering if there was a chance the ship might just split apart at the seams. But now it reminded her of the way her old pre-war apartment settled and resettled into its bones every day. You messed up. She couldn't make mistakes, not when Alice's life was at stake. She laced her fingers together, resting her forehead against them. Was she going to have to apologize for hitting him, cough up the words from some numb place inside herself, and hope she didn't throw up in the process? I won't do it. I won't, I won't, I won't. She squeezed her eyes shut.
Look at you, a regular Jack Tar.
She turned at the smoky, deep voice. The sight of Nicholas cutting a path through the dark finally popped the bubble of panic. She counted the steps between them, and he finally stopped to consider her, running a hand over his closely cropped hair. He searched her face as if wondering how to start. Etta wasn't the least bit ashamed of studying him back, but she was sure she wouldn't get much from it. Nicholas seemed to guard his expression so carefully, protecting the privacy of his thoughts. Etta shifted her eyes away from his face. She'd been right before. It was his only jacket. He wore it now, brushed clean. The fit had swallowed her, but was perfect over his white shirt, emphasizing the broad span of his shoulders. His pants hugged his legs as he crossed that last distance between them. Nicholas was tall, his muscles compact and lean. Everything about him seemed efficient, from the way he spoke to the way he moved with steady, easy grace, shifting with the sea. His presence was larger than life, bigger than even his physical body. As he stood beside her, Etta felt as warm as if he'd spread his coat over her again, wrapped her up in it.
"You've got steady legs," he explained finally, turning his eyes up. "You'll be a seasoned sailor by the time we reach port."
"I don't know about that," Etta said, following his gaze along the large central mast, to—was that a man, working on the long beam the sail was hung from? Earlier she'd seen the men climbing up and down the ropes like spiders sharing a web, but none had gone this high, high enough that she couldn't make out the man's face. He was a pale blur against the quilt of stars. It was dizzying just to look at him. "Is he going to be able to get down?" Etta asked, and realized that she was clutching his arm. He went absolutely still at the same moment she did, inhaling softly. The wool was rough against her fingertips, and the sensation lingered even after she let go and stepped back.
"He'll be fine," Nicholas said gently. "Most of us have been climbing the rigging since we were boys. The wind's picking up, so Marsden is reefing the sails, reducing their size to keep the ship stable."
She nodded, fiddling with the edge of her sleeves, trying to ease some of the tightness there. He'd said it so casually, the way Etta might tell someone she used to climb trees in Central Park. Nicholas crossed his arms over his chest again, turning his face into the breeze, eyes shut. I really hate that I ruined dinner, she said quietly. But I'm never going to be sorry about what I did. He was out of line and wrong. His lips twitched.
Alas, that meal was doomed from the moment they laid out the plates. And rest assured, you are among company that deals with considerable physical violence. A good effort is always appreciated.
I've never slapped anyone before, she admitted.
How did you find the experience?
It would have been more satisfying if he'd gone flying out of his seat like I imagined, she said. I wanted to do it the whole night, but I'm worried that what I did is going to cause more problems for you. Nicholas looked at her in what Etta thought might be utter amazement. Too late, it hit her that this also wasn't something a young woman in this time would say. She rushed on, explaining. He was trying so hard to bait you. I don't know what the next level of that is, but whatever it is, I'm worried he'll find another way of taking it out on you.
Well, he certainly won't be taking it out on you, Nicholas said, his voice harsh. Not if he values his skin. I take entirely too much pleasure from personally stripping it with the cat of nine tails.
The violence in his words was a promise. Are you sure you can't just maroon him on a remote island with a bottle of rum? Etta asked, only half kidding. Make him walk the plank straight into a shark's mouth.
Maroon him. Walk the plank.
To her surprise, he actually laughed. It felt like a reward to hear it.
Why, Miss Spencer, I believe there's a pirate's heart in you. I wish Captain Hall had stayed, if only so he could have told you some of his stories over dinner.
Too bad, she agreed, relieved that a small bit of the tension had finally eased. Do you know any good ones?
I'm not as good in the telling as he is, Nicholas said. Perhaps you'd be interested in hearing the charming tale of pirates who disemboweled and cut out the heart of a British officer, soaked it in spirits and ate it.
Her jaw dropped. Spirits? As in alcohol? Was that supposed to make it taste better?
I'd imagine few things could improve the experience, he said. But anything is possible with enough rum and courage, I suppose.
This exchange was so beyond the stilted, polite dinner conversation that it felt almost like a trap. Etta remembered Sophia's warnings, but it was such a relief to talk to someone who wasn't trying to outthink her or lord information over her. She relaxed her hold on the railing and laughed. "How do you stand it?" she heard herself ask. He turned to her, brows raised.
"I'm not sure I know what you're asking."
"The rules." She crossed her arms over her chest, letting the rise and fall of the ship anchor her at the moment. A part of her knew this was a dangerous train of thought to bring up with him, but another part of her, the one still a little clouded from the wine, didn't seem to care. "There are so many of them, aren't there? Rules on what we are and aren't allowed to talk about, where we can talk. There's probably even a rule that says we're not supposed to be talking without someone else here, isn't there?"
"Believe me, pirate. We've already traveled so far past what's deemed appropriate that I'm not sure we'll ever manage to find our way back."
"I don't have a problem with that if you don't," she said hopefully. If this got back to Sophia, what were the chances she'd be locked in her cabin and fed only scraps of salted beef slipped beneath the door? Nicholas's interest only seemed to sharpen.
"And what would your sister say about that?"
"Oh, damn." She scrambled for an explanation, feeling the heat wash up her throat the longer it took. "I wasn't raised the way Sophia was. I'm still learning what's expected of me, and clearly not doing the best job." He seemed confused by this.
"Not raised the way? You mean to say..."
What could she possibly say that would make sense here, worked through an 18th-century filter? "This family... I didn't know that Sophia even existed, that any of them did, until they came and took me. They interrupted my life, and now I have to play by their rules and do whatever they ask. And it doesn't matter what I want or how I feel. It's not my choice." Nicholas turned again, resting his arms against the railing. He had locked his thoughts away so deeply inside of his mind that Etta couldn't begin to guess at them. His expression gave nothing away as he said,
"So you would rather return to Nassau than continue to New York?"
Nassau. That was the second time it had been mentioned, so not Nassau County in New York, which meant the Bahamas. Is that an option? Can you bring me back?
No,
he said flatly, extinguishing that tiny flare of hope.
My payment depends on delivering you to New York.
Of course.
Unless you're in fear for your life.
What if I am? She interrupted. If it were up to me, I'd take one of those small boats and row myself back to shore.
Don't be a fool.
His whole body went rigid beside hers.
Aside from the fact that it would take you days before you spotted land, you wouldn't know the first thing about navigation, nor would you have enough water or food to sustain you.
So you'd keep me here against my will.
Know this, pirate, he said, his hands gripping the railing. You are my passenger, and I will be damned before I let any harm come to you.
She was unsure how to respond to the fervor of those words. Another rule, she managed finally.
A promise. If I see that you're in danger from Ironwood, I will help you escape myself. But should you try to leave on your own, know that I will go to the end of the earth to bring you back.
She felt color begin to creep up her throat, her cheeks, at the intensity of his words. You'd risk not getting your payment.
Don't be ridiculous. We'll escape after I get my payment.
He shook his head, but Etta caught the hint of teasing in his tone.
Really, Miss Spencer? You ought to surrender your colors for that.
Do pirates ever surrender? She asked. I thought they only went down in blazes of glory.
Only the bad ones, he said.
One corner of his mouth kicked up.
The rest live long enough for another war and go legitimate.
She managed a small smile. I'll keep that in mind.
You're right, he said,
studying the small scars scattered over the back of his hand.
About the rules. They go largely unspoken and without explanation.
At first, watching the men at their game had been almost funny. It was so ridiculous to hear such devastatingly polite words delivered with such obvious hatred. And then, with Wren, it had suddenly become sinister, a way to do serious harm while still fitting inside that mold of acceptability. Sophia had described it as a game, but Etta disagreed. In that first hour, the ceremonial flow of introductions, conversations, seating, had made her feel like they were part of a small orchestra. Written into every piece of music were strict rules on how to deliver the notes, how to keep the pacing, and 100 other aspects that added up to the sound and movement that the composer had intended. There wasn't much room to be playful, to reinterpret pieces. That's why Etta always tried to flood her performances with some kind of emotion, to set them apart from what was expected. The most critical judges always seemed to be looking for perfect execution over inspiration, or even passion. But both the game and orchestra metaphors were flawed. They implied that everyone was a willing participant, but the truth was she doubted that anyone was really eager to participate in the charade of society, aside from the people who created and benefited from the rules.
I choose to exist outside of it, whenever possible, Nicholas said slowly,
as if unsure whether he wanted to continue. His voice dropped, and Etta had to lean closer to listen to him.
This, having to dine with the captured officers, is a rare exception. I have no problem paying respects to the men I sail with, because I admire and appreciate them. But you're right. The falseness is tiresome, and worse, deceitful.
It seems like one of the benefits of being out here, she said, gesturing to the water, should be the ability to make your own rules.
Well, in all truth, there are more rules to follow on a ship, and they tend to be far stricter. You might have plucked young Jack from danger after the spoon fiasco, but everyone in the cabin knows he'll be disciplined for behaving that way toward an officer.
Disciplined how? Etta asked sharply. He's just a boy.
You don't have the luxury of being just a boy when you sail, Nicholas said,
not callously.
He is a member of a crew. Our rules and hierarchy add up to survival, and there's a logic and purpose to it all in maintaining order, even in the most desperate situations. The punishments for breaking them are as severe as they are, because failing to fulfill your role affects everyone.
Etta set her jaw, taking a step back from him. He'd mentioned using a kind of whip earlier, and the thought of it snapping down on the boy's bare back, the thought of him trying to take it stoically under the eyes of the crew, for doing something that everyone